Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Fails. Hello and
welcome
to When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years' War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War One.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916...
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails, remastered. Hello there, history friends. Welcome to another remastered talk episode. This time we're looking at the Crimean War. Sean and I sat down 5 years ago to look at the Crimean War. We had a great time. We had a really, really good time. And I think, well, maybe it's not the most edited talk episode that I've remastered, but there's a few things in here that were in the original that aren't in here anymore, such as my, somehow, ability to mispronounce the word hegemony. I don't understand. I used to call it hegemony, don't ask me why, but it's embarrassing and annoying and I'd rather forget about it, so I'm being honest here and letting you know about it, just in case you go, ooh, Zach, but you changed it, you don't say hegemony anymore. Yes, that's because I'm trying to pretend it never happened, and it never happened. Another thing that definitely never happened is when I said that the borders of the Ottoman Empire went to India. That never happened at all, and you know that it never happened because it's not even in this podcast. How about that? Alrighty, so I hope you enjoy this remastered talk episode. Maybe let me know, maybe let Sean know, if you can find him, wherever he is. Tell us how you feel about it. Hope you're enjoying the remastered 5 weeks to run wild. I certainly am. You guys are really responding in force, and I love it. I love you all, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Back on the podcast, and my guest, as always, is Sean. Say hello, Sean.
Hey, guys. Thanks once again, Zach, for having me on the show.
Once again, it's an absolute pleasure, Sean. I've often been told how wonderful these talk episodes are, but I think people forget that I'm only one half of the talk episode. The talk episodes would not be as special as they are if we didn't have Sean along for the ride with us. So,
well, hey, that's
thank
me.
You, Sean. Thanks. That's your shout out right there.
Yeah, shout out. Oh, like me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter. I do have a Twitter, so you can find me. And encourage my music career. It's really good. It's so wonderful. You will all love me. Actually, I'm not that great at guitar. So, yeah. Anyway, back to, you know, normal stuff. Because that was a terrible plug.
It was a really awful plug.
I'm really not. I don't even.
You need to rehearse
music.
These kinds of plugs.
I'm sorry.
Speaking of plugs,
be fit.
If you're looking for ways to support, get in contact with, or inquire about this podcast, be fit is the best way to do it by far. And now, what is be fit? What is BFIT, Sean?
Well, all I remember is the B, so blog.
WDFpodcast.blogspot.ie is where you can find that.
And the .ie also is important because he's Irish, yes. not English, not Scottish, not British. Definitely not British.
No, there's a history there, which I will go into. E is for email, wdfpodcast@hotmail.com. F is for Facebook, where you can like the Facebook page. Or, if
which you
want,
should do, yes, and go to the History Podcasters
page, which is actually taking off really, really well. And now, especially if you look at it, right, the past two episodes I've been plugging the History Podcast page. Jordan Harbour, lovely guy, does the Twilight Histories podcast. Definitely should check that out if you hadn't already. It's brilliant. But after me doing it for like 3 weeks, he does it once in his podcast. Suddenly we have 30 new members, and I'm like, ah. Oh. But seriously, the group is really, really good, and if you want to talk to, like, the History of World War II podcast guy, the History of Byzantium guy, the...
And Zach regularly puts up stuff asking your opinion.
Yeah,
and
it's a great way to get in contact with all of
us. It's a good way to get to know the podcasters.
Exactly.
And the reason they're doing it and all that stuff.
Hmm. Also, Sean is on there, so...
Oh, well, I don't have any sort of presence. I'm sure if I said hello, I'd get a who-are-you reception.
Oh, you could introduce yourself as the star of the...
Yeah.
Co-star of the talk episodes.
Of course,
yeah.
I could.
Well, it is.
I have a grand total of 5 episodes.
That's
to my
true.
Name.
You do. They're out there. Anyway, other parts of BeFit. I is for iTunes, where you can rate the podcast or
very
review the
important.
Podcast. Very important because it makes
ratings.
Me appear more famous than I actually am, which is very, very nice.
Ratings will get him onto the What's Hot page. So.
Yes, and that means that more people will see it in turn. And then T is for tell a friend, which of course is. Well, not even a friend. Just tell somebody. You don't even have to tell a friend.
Run out
just,
onto the street right now. Like, unplug your earphones, turn to the guy next to you and go, listen to this podcast, man. It is good stuff. And, like, leave it at that. Don't tell him anything else. Put your earphones back in. He'll probably get up and move.
Yeah.
Which is what you want, so you can put your bag there.
Yeah,
you know.
Of course.
So, I'm actually helping you get a better spot on the bus, car, or...
Wherever.
Where park bench.
Yeah,
like you can
exactly.
scare away all those pigeons. Definitely. Tell the pigeons to listen to this podcast. You know, people won't think you're crazy, but it'll make the pigeons go away.
Yeah. Make the pigeon. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. okay. Well, now we're going to actually start. That, like, really long plug there might seem distracting, but actually, it was all part of the plan, of course.
Yes. Okay. So, the rise of the Ottoman Empire. Let's start from there.
Okay.
The Ottomans, they don't get really much of a backstory. They don't get much of a backstory.
No,
you
they
just,
don't.
You just put them in there going, oh, they're failing, oh, they're dying.
Yeah.
And everybody wants to keep them alive or push them down.
There is, okay. Well, I did actually want to go into this, but obviously didn't have time in the other episode. There are three basic stages to the Ottoman Empire. The first is the rise and the growth, where they basically take over a lot of territory in a very short space of time.
Yeah.
And then there's a stagnation, which is when they basically...
And are they actually Turks? Are they the Turkish...
They are Turks, yes. The reason why we call
originating in modern-day Turkey.
Yeah, well, the reason why we call them the Ottomans is because of the name of the certain tribes that would eventually take over. It's like... It's very easy to compare them to when the Roman Empire was there, the tribes that would eventually take over in the east and form what was first the Seleucid Empire, and then there was the Parthian Empire, and then there was the Sassanid Empire. And those were all the result of different tribes taking over from what was there already. That happened a lot in the Ottoman Empire, and that's why we call it the Ottoman Empire / the Turkish Empire. Yeah, there's like the there's different types of Turks as well. There's the Seljuk Turks, I think is what they're called.
Right.
The Ottoman Empire was, in 1850, deceptively strong. I mean, the reason why we talk about its decline and its fall is that if you look at the Napoleonic Wars, for example, where Napoleon invaded Egypt, and he did so relatively easy, and he didn't really consider what the Ottomans would do, the fact that he was able to do that, if you contrast that to 200 years before...
Napoleon at the time was, like, revolutionary. He was beating people left, right, and centre.
Well, that is true, but at the same time, if that was the Ottoman Empire that was as strong as it was 200 years before, where nobody messed with it at all... And even though it wasn't able to break the siege of Vienna, which I'll get to a bit later on, even though it wasn't able to do that in the late 17th century, it was still considered a very dangerous force that could like come back to haunt Europe at any time.
It was Muslim, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
So
yeah.
It was seen with a bit of fear from the Christians.
Yeah, it was. But that's the thing, you see. That's the reason. That's why...
They were hoping they forgot the Crusades. Let's hope they forgot the Crusades.
Well, it wasn't so much that, but that the fact that they were Muslim added to their mysterious like the
danger,
image that people had of them. The decline of the Ottoman Empire is widely seen by historians. I'm not going to quote them because I don't have them in my head. But it's widely seen as any period from 1700 on. From then on, you see the expansion of the Russian Empire. And as a consequence of that, the influence of the Ottoman Empire starts to wane.
And now, are they under like siege? Are there rebellions happening? Are people uprising against?
Not so much.
A poor system.
From about 1700 to 1800, there wasn't so much that there was revolts or anything like that.
Right.
It was just that everyone around them seemed to be getting stronger.
Okay.
So in about the 19th century, then you had more nationalist movements. Like the Greeks is a very good example, and we'll get into the Greeks more a bit later on.
And of course, the Germans at the time, they were the nationalism was starting to take off.
Yeah,
there as well.
And
that's
even in Eastern Europe,
20 years before German unification.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
so Bismarck's running around.
Well, I'm not exactly sure if Bismarck. I don't think Bismarck is in as much. He's definitely not
in
as much power.
He's probably just 20 and running around, going, "I'm going to become amazing when I'm older."
Yeah, it's like, "No, you won't." Yes, I will. The Ottoman Empire in the 19th century starts to become plagued then by the double problem of both stronger countries outside its borders, like Russia, for example, and also the internal problems of revolts, such as the Greek one.
Right.
And that's a double problem as well, within a double problem, because not only are the Greeks revolting, but the Russian Tsars are claiming that because those Greeks are Orthodox Christians, that the Russian Tsars have to support those Orthodox Christians living in Greece.
And the Greeks were successful in doing so, which makes the Ottomans look very poor.
Yeah,
like,
and that...
The English at the time were able to maintain very close vigil over the Irish and their American states. Mm.
Well, 1776 America. Was when, but even so, like, that, I mean, everyone was... Well, I don't want to say everyone, because that's a generalization.
Yeah.
But the Ottomans had their empire for so long, it was starting to decline now. Just when others like Britain and even France and, of course, Russia were making empires elsewhere.
Yeah.
And they were by no means reducing themselves in influence, except maybe for France, which I'll get into a bit later. Okay.
No prejudice against the French, though.
No.
Wonderful people. Different culture to ours, though.
Yeah.
It's just it.
Okay, I want to talk about Austria a bit now.
Oh, okay. Yes, Austria, it's got, I was looking at some of the maps, it's got its borders right on the...
Austria was in a very strategic position, and actually at one stage during the Danube campaign, the Russians were moving down through Eastern Europe, trying to convince the countries, the modern day states of, say, Bulgaria, they were trying to convince that to revolt against Ottoman rule. It was only when... the Austrians started moving an army. At one stage, they had 280,000 men on their border with the Ottoman provinces.
Yeah.
And once the Eastern European countries showed no signs of wanting to break away from the Ottoman yoke, that was when Russia decided to withdraw a bit more. Russia was initially hoping to flip all the countries that had been under Ottoman domination in Eastern Europe. They were hoping to flip them over to either to their side, or to create such a hostile environment that the Ottomans would have to abandon it and lose a lot of influence there.
Okay.
Because don't forget, the Ottoman Empire stretched not just in as far as India and stuff, but also into along the Danube. Like, they had Trajan's Wall there, was considered part of their borders. I mean, that's as far as the Russians reached, and they besieged a few cities. I can't remember one of the names of the one of them was one of the cities that they besieged anyway. They were besieging that city, and then they broke off when they realized that the nationalism wasn't strong enough in that area. For it was in Bulgaria. They realized that the Bulgarians didn't want independence enough to rebel against the Ottomans. And then there was the added threat of Austria, which was the original point, was that the Austrians played such a pivotal role that they convinced the Russians to move away.
Now, the Austrians, they recently came into Hungary. They were...
Yeah, the Hungarian revolt is interesting. I want to get into it a bit because it helps to explain why the Russians thought they had Austria as a firm ally. In 1848, the Hungarians, who were part of the Austrian Empire, which stretched far into Eastern Europe and bordered the Ottoman provinces over the Danube, Hungary, which was then part of Austria, revolted and tried to seek its own independence.
Right.
And it had done this before. It had done this before, I think, during the Seven Years' War, if that's right. I'm not 100% sure, but it had done that before. But this time, Austria was very, very much at a disadvantage, and it really relied on the aid given by Russia, who helped to put the rising down.
They owed him one. They were like, yeah, these guys, we bought them out in the last 10 years. They're definitely going to side with us.
Yeah.
So then Austria just flips straight away. France and Britain, who are making a huge amount of clamour about the destruction of the Ottomans' Black Sea fleet.
Yeah.
They just flip straight away. Is that due to the British propaganda, or is it advantageous? It's
a few things, really. Okay. I mean, there was the general idea that hadn't been fully accepted yet in Austria that the fall of the Ottoman Empire would be a bad thing. For a while, it was only a few states like Britain and France who genuinely believed that if the Ottoman Empire was to fall, then that would be bad. But it was only when Austria came to the realization that if the Ottoman Empire fell and Russia took over from what the Ottoman Empire had, even if it just took over the straits like the Dardanelles and capitalized on the trade monopoly there, how much stronger that would have made Russia. And even though you might say, oh, well, Austria and Russia are allies, so that doesn't really matter. But if your ally is way, way stronger than you, you might find after a while it's not as much of a friendly ally as it was anymore.
Yeah, it's going to be a very one-sided relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to start demanding things you don't want to give
it. I'm protecting you now. It's like, well, we're not a part of you. Yeah. Well, you better listen to what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
We're way bigger than you and we could take you if we want to.
Austria probably had the biggest impact in the war. Like, in terms of the countries that didn't declare war, Austria definitely had the biggest impact.
Right, so for all the neutral nations, they were huge.
Oh, by far, yeah. I mean, Austria, this is very much strategic diplomacy on the part of Austria. It was making sure, like, it was basically doing...
It was
adopting
a British policy.
Yeah, it was. But
to maintain balance.
But the thing is, you see, the British policy was very much being seen as a European policy.
Right.
The idea that the Ottomans had to be propped up became pretty much the policy of Europe.
Yeah.
Once
because can you imagine if Russia took there, they would have just spread the whole way.
Yeah,
down,
I mean, who's to say they would have been? Yeah, who's to say they would have been stopped?
That's
a
lot of containment they've been feeling.
Yeah, I mean, you could say poor Russia, but at the same time, the Tsars always knew what they were doing.
Right.
As soon as Peter the Great had emerged from the Great Northern War of the early of 1700 to 1721, as soon as Sweden had been defeated in Scandinavia, that basically left Russia as the dominant power in not only Eastern Europe, but also Scandinavia as well.
Right.
There was very little to stop it. And once the Napoleonic Wars had ended, that was when Britain and France really realised, hold on a minute, there's another entity here.
Yeah,
it's not just the two of us.
They have the resources to pull.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they still had massively underdeveloped resources. They still had serfdom, which I said. So that made them seem backward, but because of their size, they had the largest land army in Europe. So they were very much feared, not just in Britain and France, but in Austria to a lesser extent because they were allies, but also in Prussia as well.
Yeah, and I'm sure the Ottomans were aware of their power.
Oh, definitely, yeah, because the Ottomans began to decline the same time the Russians started to go right up.
Yeah, when the Russians destroyed the fleet, was that the declaration of war?
No, that wasn't the Russians destroyed the Turkish fleet in the Black Sea on November 30th, 1853. That was pretty much the wake-up call, not just for Britain and France, who had already kind of planned to declare war at some stage, but also for Austria, who then realised that not only was the Ottoman Empire open to the kind of exploitation that Britain and France were fearing, but also that it really kind of hit home the point to Austria that the Ottomans, if they were defeated, it would be bad for everyone.
It would. That's it.
So it was pretty much a key moment. I mean, if you were Russian and you're destroying your enemy's fleet, that might seem like a good thing. But in the grand scheme of things, it was catastrophic because it really did.
It should have been a coordinated assault where they had just like swept in all at once instead of knocking out one pillar at a time. Because you knock out one pillar and everyone else wants to keep the structure from collapsing, they're going to get in there and keep it up.
You can't blame the Russians for acting in the war as they did. But at the same time, European power politics was just completely changing. Like, nationalism was changing things too much for anyone to really keep track of it. And this had become especially apparent in the Austrian Empire once the Austrians start to see exactly how bad it can be when their Balkan territories start to revolt.
Now, this is the Austria that's so powerful. It's it at the moment is the image of Germany, like as a Germanic state.
Yeah.
So Prussia doesn't really play any major important roles.
No, but at the same time, it's definitely arising. Like I'd say this is just me thinking aloud, but I'd say that the vast majority of Europe had their eye on Prussia, especially because after the Napoleonic Wars. Anyone would be forgiven for thinking, oh, that's the end of Prussia, because they'd been defeated by Napoleon so thoroughly. Yes. Instead of it being defeated, though, and instead of it languishing in like a really bad state, it started to grow in power and influence, probably due to the general decline of the Austrians, who really declined as well after the Napoleonic Empire.
Right.
Yeah.
Even though they were still taking on.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were, but...
They were being assisted by Russia.
Yeah,
okay.
That just shows you how far the Austrians have gone, that they had to be helped by Russia. Mm. So that was kind of a snowballing effect. Those German states who had previously been aligned, at least in theory, to Austria, now started to see more of an idea, not just of safety, but also the general idea of a German state.
Yeah.
That seemed to be more of a possibility with Prussia.
Yeah.
So they started to ally themselves with Prussia, and thus that's where you get the Northern German Confederation.
Yes.
Yeah,
I like how we started in the Ottoman Empire and slowly worked our way towards the other side of Europe. Yes, so France and Britain, they declare war in...
On March 28th, 1854, they declare war as a result of the ultimatum that they had sent.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Tsar not being upheld.
Right. And so, like, if you're a Russian, you look at this and you go, well, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, well,
what
I
do you
mean,
expect us to
Yeah,
do?
I know. I mean, but at the same time, they had hoped. It was kind of like reverse psychology. They wanted Russia to refuse so that they could appear as not the aggressors, but someone coming to the justice of Turkey.
So a noble crusade, almost.
Almost, yeah. But at the same time, the terms were completely ridiculous.
Mm.
But unless you put them into the context of the balance of power that Britain so often trumpeted, because at this stage, Russia was definitely violating that idea, because it was just too strong and too powerful. And it had to be taken down a peg, as what I said.
Austrians don't declare war, but they move troops against Russia.
Yeah, it's what those troops suggest that really repelled Russia from it. Not the fact that they were at war, but the fact that if they declared war and sent those troops against us when we're like in the thick of battle, how catastrophic that would be for our planning.
Yeah, I mean, it really is the utmost of betrayal from Austria. That's really disappointing for the Russians.
It is, because they, like... They seem completely alone in Europe now.
Yeah, they do.
I want to get into the suffering of the soldiers a bit. I know I didn't really talk about Florence Nightingale.
I didn't know there was even...
Oh,
the soldiers were suffering?
Oh, horrendously. Like, the Crimean War is famous because it was so badly carried out.
And famous for Florence Nightingale.
Yeah, well, Florence Nightingale's famous for, like, making the sufferings of the soldiers so clear. Like, right. she brought attention to the fact that the soldiers were dying of dysentery and cholera.
So and they weren't even dying of killing
each other. More people died from disease than actual warfare, which is the awful... Yeah, which is the awful thing. That's what made... Terrible. Yeah,
and
that's...
Was that equal on both Russian and Ottoman sides?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
It's probably because, you know, the Russians, they're a little bit backward and the Ottomans are in decline. Now, was it true of the Austrians as well that were just camped on the... camped on the border?
I'm not so sure about that.
Because I'd say they'd probably have facilities.
Yeah.
They've got all of the manufacturing and industry that the Germans have to offer, so...
It was just badly carried out, really, the entire war. Like, even, I went into it a bit, the sea journey from Britain to Varna, which is on the east coast, the west coast of the
British
Black Sea.
British and French troops were also suffering.
Oh, yeah, they were, completely. Oh, like, British troops suffered horrendously in this war.
Different climate.
Oh, yeah. Like, obviously, they were given no time to acclimatise. So once they landed, then they were suddenly faced with this different climate, which brought it with it loads of diseases.
And
yeah. I mean, there was... Yeah, there
everything.
Was one stage where they were camped so close together that the cholera and the dysentery just spread like wildfire.
Oh, my goodness.
So they moved them to a nearby lake, and, of course, everyone caught malaria.
That's absolutely terrible.
So it was just... And not only that... But this was compounded by the fact that their commanders were like the landed gentry. They weren't there.
So they had absolutely no heart for the men.
No, not only did they have no heart, but they had no idea of strategic initiative or anything like that.
Right. They needed someone to plan.
Exactly.
Camps,
yeah.
That just didn't happen.
Yeah, the British soldiers were being commanded, and the French in part as well. But the British are more famous for this because of the sales of military commissions. Like, if you had the money. You could get promoted just by the fact that you had money and you were willing to buy the ranks. Now, this is interesting because you might be wondering, oh, why did the British do that when it was so obviously going to kick them back in the face? But if you think about what the British had just been through, the one thing that they seemed to remember from the Napoleonic Wars was not how bad war was, but how those dangerous ideas had festered themselves, and because those dangerous ideas had been there and all the people at the head of the French army had agreed with them, then that revolution was able to succeed. The idea was that if you get aristocrats to head armies, then if a revolution comes along, those aristocrats aren't going to agree with that revolution.
Of course.
So
absolutely.
They won't lead those
that
troops.
That makes a lot of sense. But aristocrats aren't designed
to
lead armies.
Exactly, yeah. I said it in the episode, only six of them went to the Royal Military Academy in Sandhurst.
Oh my goodness.
That means, I don't know the exact number, but obviously it was in the high hundreds, the amount of people that ended up being generals and stuff,
my goodness.
Who had absolutely no amount of command at all.
I'm sure they had aides that were very well qualified as
soldiers. Well, they would have had aides, but when it comes down to it, the guy in the fancy uniform makes the decisions, and if those decisions are absolutely awful...
Yeah, oh my goodness. Then, so it sounds catastrophic that should be the case.
Yeah, it sounds almost hilarious if it wasn't so tragic.
Yeah.
Like, that's where you get the charge of the Light Brigade.
Right.
Because a breakdown in communications and...
Was that the 600... 600 horsemen straight into the teeth of people's guns.
Cannons on. They ran down a mile-long valley. Lord Raglan, right? Let's just set the scene first. Lord Raglan gave the order to Lord Lucan, who was meant to pass the order on to Lord Cardigan. Now, Lord Lucan and Lord Cardigan didn't like each other at all. So when Lord Lucan passed the order that he'd been given by Lord Raglan to advance up the valley and attack the Russian positions, Lord Cardigan was like, "What are you saying? There's loads of cannons there." And Lord Lucan said, "Well, that's not my fault. He just told me to go and attack those cannons, so go and attack them." So Lord Cardigan, instead of debating this, decided that he wasn't going to talk to the guy, Lord Lucan, because he didn't like Lord Lucan. So what ended up happening was, even though Lord Cardigan knew that it was a really, really dangerous thing to do, he still attacked the positions. Lord Lucan knew that it was so dangerous because they'd been doing reconnaissance there, and they knew very well that the cannons were there.
You know, I think this is like drama that should end up on the big screen.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Seriously.
I mean,
we have Big Brother and stuff. That is Big Brother in the extreme.
The plight of the soldiers, though, who were at the common private or whatever, who was at the mercy of this guy, Lord Cardigan or Lord Lucan, who because of their personal rivalry and hatred for each other, wouldn't even talk out the possibilities of another option or anything. It was just attack that position
awful.
At the end of the valley.
That's awful.
Surrounded on all sides by cannons, what do you expect to happen? And thus, like, a horrendous... It was so awful. Like, the amount of people that died just because these two wouldn't talk to each other and talk it out properly.
Terrible.
Yeah. That's why the charge of the Light Brigade is held up and the Crimean War as well. It's the last war where people can buy commissions. After the Crimean War, the British learned their lesson and they abolished that.
Yeah, but oh my goodness.
Thankfully, otherwise it would have gotten far worse, especially like, with World War One.
Well, I mean, World War One was still... Like,
yeah, it was very bad. Yeah. But at least those...
Maybe if they had generals that were actually, you know, constantly training the war through the last century, they might have had better tactics. But that little lapse in development of tactics by having morons or lords to take care of the armies, that might have actually have caused the First World War to be so atrocious.
Yeah, I mean, you saw, I don't want, obviously we're not going to talk about the First World War too
much.
Though
we love it.
Yeah, we do love it. And it is definitely an episode to come in the future.
Mm-hmm. After the Boer War, though.
Yeah, everyone seems to really want the Boer War as well.
It's only because that was the last time the British and the Irish really fought alongside each other.
And against the Dutch as well, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into... Oh, I want to talk about the Schleswig-Holstein incident in 1848, which I did mention briefly, but I want to just get into a bit now, because 1848 is a pretty important year. Not only did you have the Revolution of Hungary, but you also had this event, which happened in southern Denmark, where Prussia and its Northern Confederation of Allied German States wanted to expand and take on as many German-speaking states as possible.
So they tried to get... Denmark.
Yeah, they tried to get this place in southern Denmark. And because that would have involved holding onto those straits, that would have made it so powerful, the Russians and the British were able to cooperate and were able to say, no, don't do that. Which is unusual, because 6 years later they'd be at war.
It's just the balance thing. That
The balance of power. This was the one thing Britain and Russia seemed to agree on, that they didn't want someone like Prussia controlling the straits. The straits that I'm talking about are in Scandinavia, where a lot of trade would pass through. I mean, St. Petersburg at this stage, which was the capital, not Moscow, and St. Petersburg was in the Baltic. So any trade that would have to go to St. Petersburg would have to get through the straits that Prussia was trying to control. So that obviously had to be stopped at all costs.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. Like that would have hampered the Russians a lot.
But the reason why that's so important is because in 1848, once Britain and Russia team up to take on and repel the idea that Prussia had that it wanted to take Schleswig-Holstein, once they did that, Prussia got very upset about that wall that had been put up.
And that's when Prussia starts to feel alone and starts looking for allies.
Yeah, and that's why it turns to Austria, but even though it'll turn on Austria in a few years' time. But the reason why it's so important is because Prussia is seen as a non-entity in this war because it has an issue not only with Russia because of what Russia did, but also with Britain because of what Britain and Russia did together. Right. So it becomes a neutral, which is more concerned with expanding its influence over Germany, far more than what Russia or Turkey or Britain or France are doing in the Dardanelles or in the Black Sea.
Okay.
And you might be thinking, oh, why is that important? What could Prussia possibly do? But if you think about like how history, they say, like hangs on a knife edge, if Prussia had sent 100,000 soldiers, say they were on the side of the Russians, for example, for whatever reason, if they were, this is just speculation, obviously, say they were, what would have happened? Would the Danube been overcome by the combined Prusso-Russian force?
You've got the it's a double-sided. So you've got the Germans who are the Prussians who would be fighting the Austrians, the Austrians who would be fighting the Russians, and the French who would be fighting the Prussians. So it would be a double-sided.
Another thing to consider is if Prussia ended up going into the war on the side of Russia, which was more likely than going in the side of Britain, because Britain wasn't happy with the way Prussia was conducting itself, especially with respect to Hanover, which was a former monarchy province, because that's where all the previous kings had come from.
Right, and that's who was currently ruling Britain, was a Hanover guy?
No, this was earlier in the 18th century, from about 1710, I think, onwards. Britain was ruled by Hanoverian monarchs, but... they still felt a certain level of attachment, and Prussia's idea that it had to control as many German-speaking lands as possible, which would actually re-manifest itself later on with Hitler, if you want to see that, with all his German-speaking people. The idea, if Prussia went on the side of Russia, then Austria wouldn't have been able to allow that, because they would have felt threatened by Prussia and Russia combining their strength.
Yeah.
So it would have become not just a localized war, but a world war, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. And a world war at that time, with the poor sanitation.
Yeah, that it would have been absolutely catastrophic. Yeah. And who's to say what would have happened in that war? I mean, obviously, the speculation's kind of getting out of hand at this stage.
Really, really out of hand.
Yeah, but I do think it's interesting to think of these things. Yeah, like, who's to say there would have been a World War One if so many people had died in that resulting speculated conflict?
Like, exactly.
Yeah.
And then that might have just neutralized World War II completely.
Well, yeah, I mean, I often say that without World War One, there would be no World War II, because Hitler wouldn't have been able to capitalize on the anger of the people.
And then without Bismarck, there'd be no World War One either.
Yeah, I mean, like, German unification could have happened earlier, or even later, because Austria had been if Austria had been strengthened,
it would have happened anyway. Yeah. Anyway, we're getting into we're getting into our previous podcast. Yeah. It's just so interesting. Yeah. We love talking about
it. We really do, and we could talk about it for ages. Yeah, obviously,
we love Prussia.
Prussia.
If you are Prussian, please contact us.
Yeah. yeah, literally could talk about this for hours.
So when does the actual conflict on land in the Ottoman and Russian conflict end?
Okay, well, the peace treaty is signed on, I think it's the 30th of March, 1856, is when the Treaty of Paris is signed. And after that, then everyone is at peace. The the British,
and
the French...
And is this the peace that... that lasts all the way up to the
unification
war.
Obviously, the peace is broken in Europe with that war, with the Franco-Prussian War. But other than that, it lasts pretty much unchanged until World War One, which means Russia is pretty much unchanged. Although subsequent, like, little collapses, smaller scale collapses in the Ottoman Empire means that those provinces along the Danube.
It's so interesting to think that if the Ottomans weren't propped up, they wouldn't have been a player in the First World War.
No, not at all. Not at all. This was really a stay of execution for them, this entire war was.
Yeah.
But if, like, you'll see it eventually, the reason why Austria is so unstable going into World War One is because it absorbs all the territories from the Ottomans along the Danube, which were at that stage vying for more nationalist ideas than they had been in 1850. Because nationalism by 1914 was a lot more prevalent than it had been in 1850. Okay, so the fighting on land ends on March 30th, 1856, and once that's over, then there is the general idea that things are going to change. I mean, we can see them change just 15 years later in the Franco-Prussian War, when this whole new state of Germany is created, and that changes everything drastically with respect to Russia and France and Austria and Britain.
Were those straits so pivotally important that it required that war? Like
the Dardanelles. Well, it wasn't so much the straits. Like, obviously the straits were important because of the trade they controlled.
They were a good excuse.
Yeah, they were a good excuse, but
they should have just given it to the Dutch. Then no one would mess with us. Like, seriously.
I don't know. I don't know if the Dutch would actually be able to support, but that's a completely other issue.
Yeah, I mean, the Dutch, they weren't able to support their American colonies, but you give them somewhere that can profit them a lot. Yeah,
that would be a very, very random land grab if the Dutch just arrive at the Dardanelles.
Well, that's the thing. The Ottomans, no one would expect it, and then they'd be like, boom, it's ours now.
Yeah.
No one would question it. They'd be like, well, the Netherlands, we're gonna go to... Well, would you like us to stop trading with you? Oh, wow, that's a lot of pushing power you've got there, Netherlands. Yes, it is. So you better let us keep it.
Yeah, I mean, well, you look at, like... the years following the Crimean War,
the Dardanelles just
obviously Turkey continues to own the Dardanelles because Istanbul.
It's going to be favored towards the British and French, so their trade is going to flourish there.
Yes, which is why it is strange that the Ottomans turn and joined the Central Powers in World War One, but that is also because they still harbored a grudge against Russia, and Russia was a part of the Allied powers.
Okay, right.
So if you look at it like that, it's all diplomacy, folks. It really
is. And diplomacy, it seems pretty simple now. We're all friends, but
it just shows how quickly alliances can flip flop as well.
Yeah.
The way in the space of 50 years, the alliances have completely changed.
Yeah.
Apart from Britain and France. Well, of course, this is going into World War One, but, like, it just shows how much things can change.
Yeah, exactly. And though the French and the British were allied at the time of the so it wasn't too odd for them to do that.
Well, like, actually,
the age-old enemy became the one-time stand friend.
You actually see this happen. The Crimean War is the greatest example, but you see this happen in a lot of the smaller colonial wars, especially which ones like in China. There's a pretty important one in China.
Yeah,
there is the lesser-known ones that happen in the 1860s, but there's also the Boxer Rebellion in the early 1900s that's pretty brutal. But if you look at the way Britain and France conduct themselves in this war, it seems almost incredible that after so long fighting each other, they suddenly turn on and suddenly decide to be allies. But
I'm sure it's something to do with the aristocracy commanding the armies. I'm sure they were pretty good friends.
Well, you could say that, but it's also...
I'm just going to go pop over to Paris and enjoy some of their wine. I'll be back in a moment.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. I need to get on my ship so I can go fight a war. Sorry! Yeah.
Well, it's a sign... it's a sign of the way things are changing, especially once Germany...
Sorry for the really poor English accent. I apologize.
It's okay.
All our English.
Well, some people think that we're British anyway.
Well,
so.
Okay, no, that's fine. You know what? I'll stick to it.
Okay, well, we're coming to the end of the episode now. Is there anything you'd like to add at all? You got the floor is entirely yours.
Okay. Well, the conflict seems a little bit futile, but at the same time, it's good. It was necessary. It was something that the French and the British needed to do to keep the Ottomans in the picture for another 50 years, 60 years. It was successful.
Yeah.
Like, for that, it was successful.
Yeah.
And it just dissolved once the French and the British had to fight it. It was gone.
It lost
all of its support.
I mean, I often think of the Crimean War in my head, like, I label it in my head as a very pointless war, but one whose implications had drastic effects on the future of Europe.
Exactly. It set up the grudge that the Ottomans would be willing to sacrifice its support for to fight against the Russians.
Yeah. So it's very important. It's an important war in terms of its consequences, but not in terms of what people actually fought for.
And I'm sure wars fought after that had a bit more planning and a bit more sanitary...
because people learned their lessons.
Yes, but the chemistry revolution where we started developing drugs and penicillin.
Really?
For the First World War.
Yeah.
So, after that, obviously not during the 1850s.
No.
But, you know, once you get to the First World War, when they're fighting that war.
There is a general desire to find better medical treatments for soldiers.
Which is good to see.
It's good to see. I mean, you could see it as a positive of the war that diseases like tuberculosis were able to be cured because of the search search for better medicine. Okay, so thank you all for listening, and thank you very much, Sean, for joining me again.
Thank you for listening to our ramblings.
Yes. They won't seem nearly as bad now because they've been edited out, but
okay.
I assure you there were plenty of ramblings in there. I'd just like to remind you one more time to join the Facebook group, which is really growing, History Podcasts, in capital letters.
He's going to link it in the description.
I am actually going to link it in the description because I just had enough and I want people there. So, we're going to take our leave now. You've been listening to When Diplomacy Fails. I am Zach.
And I'm Sean.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.